Chapter 13. Mr. Pumblecook's premises in the high street of the market town were of a peppercorny and farinaceous character, as the premises of a corn chandler and seedsman should be. It appeared to me that he must be a very happy man indeed, to have so many little drawers in his shop, and I wondered when I peeped into one or two on the lower tiers, and saw the tied up brown paper packets inside, whether the flower seeds and bulbs ever wanted of a fine day, to break out of those jails, and bloom. It was in the early morning after my arrival that I entertained this speculation. On the previous night, I had been sent straight to bed in an attic with a sloping roof, which was so low in the corner where the bedstead was, that I calculated the tiles as being within a foot of my eyebrows. In the same early morning, I discovered a singular affinity between seats and corduroys. Mr. Pumblecook wore corduroys, and so did his shopman, and somehow, there was a general air and flavor about the corduroys, so much in the nature of seats, and a general air and flavor about the seats, so much in the nature of corduroys, that I hardly knew which was which. The same opportunity served me for noticing that Mr. Pumblecook appeared to conduct his business by looking across the street at the saddler, who appeared to transact his business by keeping his eye on the coachmaker, who appeared to get on in life by putting his hands in his pockets and contemplating the baker, who in his turn folded his arms and stared at the grocer, who stood at his door and yawned at the chemist. The watchmaker, always poring over a little desk with a magnifying glass at his eye, and always inspected by a group of smock frocks poring over him through the glass of his shop window, seemed to be about the only person in the high street whose trade engaged his attention. Mr. Pumblecook and I breakfasted at 8 o'clock in the parlor behind the shop, while the shopman took his mug of tea and hunch of bread and butter on a sack of peas in the front premises. I considered Mr. Pumblecook wretched company. Besides being possessed by my sister's idea that a mortifying and penitential character ought to be imparted to my diet besides giving me as much crumb as possible in combination with as little butter, and putting such a quantity of warm water into my milk that it would have been more candid to have left the milk out altogether, his conversation consisted of nothing but arithmetic. On my politely bidding him good morning, he said, pompously, 7 times 9, boy? And how should I be able to answer, dodged in that way, in a strange place, on an empty stomach? I was hungry, but before I had swallowed a morsel, he began a running sum that lasted all through the breakfast. 7, and 4, and 8, and 6, and 2, and 10, and so on. And after each figure was disposed of, it was as much as I could do to get a bite or a sup before the next came, while he sat at his ease guessing nothing, and eating bacon and hot roll, in, if I may be allowed the expression, a gorging and gourmandizing manner. For such reasons I was very glad when 10 o'clock came, and we started for Miss Havisham's, though I was not at all at my ease regarding the manner in which I should acquit myself under that lady's roof. Within a quarter of an hour we came to Miss Havisham's house, which was of old brick, and dismal, and had a great many iron bars to it. Some of the windows had been walled up. Of those that remained, all the lower were rustily barred. There was a courtyard in front, and that was barred. So, we had to wait, after ringing the bell, until someone should come to open it. While we waited at the gate, I peeped in. Even then Mr. Pumblecook said, and 14, but I pretended not to hear him, and saw that at the side of the house there was a large brewery. No brewing was going on in it, and none seemed to have gone on for a long, long time. A window was raised, and a clear voice demanded, what name? To which my conductor replied, Pumblecook. The voice returned, quite right, and the window was shut again, and a young lady came across the courtyard, with keys in her hand. This, said Mr. Pumblecook, is Pip. This is Pip, is it? Returned the young lady, who was very pretty, and seemed very proud. Come in, Pip. Mr. Pumblecook was coming in also, when she stopped him with the gate. Oh, she said. Did you wish to see Miss Havisham? If Miss Havisham wished to see me, returned Mr. Pumblechook, discomfited. Ah, said the girl, but you see she don't. She said it so finally, and in such an undiscussable way, that Mr. Pumblechook, though in a condition of ruffled dignity, could not protest. But he eyed me severely, as if I had done anything to him, and departed with the words reproachfully delivered. Boy, let your behavior here be a credit unto them which brought you up by hand. I was not free from apprehension that he would come back to propound through the gate, and 16. But he didn't. My young conductress locked the gate, and we went across the courtyard. It was paved and clean, but grass was growing in every crevice. The brewery buildings had a little lane of communication with it, and the wooden gates of that lane stood open, and all the brewery beyond stood open, away to the high enclosing wall, and all was empty and disused. The cold wind seemed to blow colder there than outside the gate, and it made a shrill noise in howling in and out at the open sides of the brewery, like the noise of wind in the rigging of a ship at sea. She saw me looking at it, and she said, you could drink without hurt all the strong beer that's brewed there now, boy. I should think I could, miss, said I, in a shy way. Better not try to brew beer there now, or it would turn out sour, boy, don't you think so? It looks like it, miss. Not that anybody means to try, she added, for that's all done with, and the place will stand as idle as it is, till it falls. As to strong beer, there's enough of it in the cellars already, to drown the manor house. Is that the name of this house, miss? One of its names, boy. It has more than one, then, miss? One more. Its other name was Sadis, which is Greek, or Latin, or Hebrew, or all three or all one to me for enough. Enough house, said I, that's a curious name, miss. Yes, she replied, but it meant more than it said. It meant, when it was given, that whoever at this house could want nothing else. They must have been easily satisfied in those days, I should think. But don't loiter, boy. Though she called me boy so often, and with a carelessness that was far from complimentary, she was of about my own age. She seemed much older than I, of course, being a girl, and beautiful and self-possessed. And she was as scornful of me as if she had been 21 and a queen. We went into the house by a side door. The great front entrance had two chains across it outside, and the first thing I noticed was that the passages were all dark, and that she had left a candle burning there. She took it up, and we went through more passages, and up a staircase, and still it was all dark, and only the candle lighted us. At last we came to the door of a room, and she said, go in. I answered, more in shyness than politeness, after you, miss. To this, she returned, don't be ridiculous, boy, I am not going in. And scornfully walked away, and what was worse took the candle with her. This was very uncomfortable, and I was half afraid. However, the only thing to be done, being to knock at the door, I knocked, and was told from within to enter. I entered, therefore, and found myself in a pretty large room, well lighted with wax candles. No glimpse of daylight was to be seen in it. It was a dressing room, as I supposed from the furniture, though much of it was of forms, and uses then quite unknown to me. But prominent in it was a draped table with a gilded-looking glass, and that I made out at first sight to be a fine lady's dressing table. Whether I should have made out this object so soon, if there had been no fine lady sitting at it, I cannot say. In an armchair, with an elbow resting on the table, and her head leaning on that hand, sat the strangest lady I have ever seen, or shall ever see. She was dressed in rich materials, satins, and lace, and silks all of white. Her shoes were white, and she had a long white veil dependent from her hair, and she had bridal flowers in her hair, but her hair was white. Some bright jewels sparkled on her neck, and on her hands, and some other jewels lay sparkling on the table. dresses, less splendid than the dress she wore, and half-packed trunks, were scattered about. She had not quite finished dressing, for she had but one shoe on, the other was on the table near her, and her veil was but half arranged. Her watch and chain were not put on, and some lace for her bosom lay with those trinkets, and with her handkerchief, and gloves, and some flowers, and a prayer book, all confusedly heaped about the looking glass. It was not in the first few moments that I saw all these things, though I saw more of them in the first moments than might be supposed. But I saw that everything within my view which ought to be white, had been white long ago, and had lost its luster, and was faded and yellow. I saw that the bride within the bridal dress had withered like the dress, and like the flowers, and had no brightness left, but the brightness of her sunken eyes. I saw that the dress had been put upon the rounded figure of a young woman, and that the figure upon which it now hung loose, had shrunk to skin and bone. Once, I had been taken to see some ghastly waxwork at the fair, representing I know not what impossible personage lying in state. Once, I had been taken to one of our old marsh churches, to see a skeleton in the ashes of a rich dress, that had been dug out of a vault under the church pavement. Now, waxwork and skeleton seemed to have dark eyes that moved and looked at me. I should have cried out, if I could. "Who is it?" said the lady at the table. "Pip, ma'am." "Pip?" "Mr. Pumblecook's boy, ma'am. Come to play. Come nearer, let me look at you. Come close." It was when I stood before her, avoiding her eyes, that I took note of the surrounding objects in detail, and saw that her watch had stopped at 9:20, and that a clock in the room had stopped at 9:20. "Look at me," said Miss Havisham. "You are not afraid of a woman who has never seen the sun, since you were born?" I regret to state that I was not afraid of telling the enormous lie comprehended in the answer "no." "Do you know what I touch here?" she said, laying her hands, one upon the other, on her left side. "Yes, ma'am." It made me think of the young man. "What do I touch?" "Your heart." "Broken." She uttered the word with an eager look, and with strong emphasis, and with a weird smile that had a kind of boast in it. Afterwards, she kept her hands there for a little while, and slowly took them away, as if they were heavy. "I am tired," said Miss Havisham. "I want diversion, and I have done with men and women. Play." I think it will be conceded by my most disputatious reader that she could hardly have directed an unfortunate boy to do anything in the wide world more difficult to be done under the circumstances. "I sometimes have sick fancies," she went on, "and I have a sick fancy that I want to see some play. There, there." With an impatient movement of the fingers of her right hand, "Play, play, play." For a moment, with the fear of my sisters working me before my eyes, I had a desperate idea of starting round the room in the assumed character of Mr. Pumblecook's chaise cart. But I felt myself so unequal to the performance that I gave it up, and stood looking at Miss Havisham in what I suppose she took for a dogged manner, inasmuch as she said, when we had taken a good look at each other, "Are you sullen and obstinate?" "No, ma'am, I am very sorry for you, and very sorry I can't play just now. If you complain of me, I shall get into trouble with my sister, so I would do it if I could. But it's so new here, and so strange, and so fine, and melancholy." I stopped, fearing I might say too much, or had already said it, and we took another look at each other. Before she spoke again, she turned her eyes from me, and looked at the dress she wore, and at the dressing table, and finally at herself in the looking glass. "So new to him," she muttered, "so old to me, so strange to him, so familiar to me, so melancholy to both of us. Call Estella." As she was still looking at the reflection of herself, I thought she was still talking to herself, and kept quiet. "Call Estella," she repeated, flashing a look at me. "You can do that. Call Estella. At the door." To stand in the dark in a mysterious passage of an unknown house, bawling Estella to a scornful young lady neither visible nor responsive, and feeling it a dreadful liberty so, to roar out her name, was almost as bad as playing to order. But, she answered at last, and her light came along the dark passage like a star. Miss Havisham beckoned her to come close, and took up a jewel from the table, and tried its effect upon her fair young bosom, and against her pretty brown hair. Your own, one day, my dear, and you will use it well. Let me see you play cards with this boy. With this boy? Why, he is a common laboring boy. I thought I overheard Miss Havisham answer, only it seemed so unlikely. Well, you can break his heart. What do you play, boy? Asked Estella of myself, with the greatest disdain. Nothing but beggar my neighbor, miss. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.